together. Thank you for your word, your truth that's there. I pray you'd help us again as we walk through this book of Exodus, that you'd help us to get a clear picture of you and your desire for us as we recognize you don't desire just box-checking obedience, but you desire us to love you first and then to obey you because of the love you've shown to us, Lord. I pray that you would help us and guide us and direct us. Lord, thank you for this opportunity and the freedom to do so. We ask this in your name. Amen. All right. Exodus chapter 20. No, we're not there yet. We're in 21 still. And we're in the section that I call laws about slaves. There's mixtures of stuff in here. And looking through it, you probably could actually, you know, now say this is laws about, you actually add a letter in there, a letter or a number concerning death, I guess, if you will. You could actually add that if you wanted to, because this section that starts at verse 12 goes into this relationship really with death, with murder, kind of. And he explains some of it. And he's actually, this is kind of an introductory statement. He does that a couple ways here. He gives a couple introductory statements that he's going to expound on later on. Really, this whole section of murder and death is all going to be expounded on later on. We get to the section regarding what we today call manslaughter or unintentional, causing death unintentionally. He's going to talk about that in Numbers 35 when he talks about the cities of refuge. And so these are kind of just introductory statements, if you will, that are going to be more fully defined later on. And so we will probably look a little bit at those further definitions, but we won't spend a lot of time because we're going to get there eventually someday anyway. And if we die before we get there, then we'll know the answer because we'll all be in heaven and we won't have to worry about it. So we're at 21 verse 12. And you don't need new papers unless you haven't gotten one for several weeks. He says this: whoever strikes a man so that he dies shall be put to death. But if he did not lie in wait for him, but God let him fall into his hand, then I will appoint you a place to which he may flee. But if a man willfully attacks another to kill him by cunning, you shall take him from my altar that he may die. Whoever strikes his father and mother shall be put to death. Whoever steals a man, sells him, and anyone found in possession of him shall be put to death. Whoever curses his father or his mother shall be put to death. We'll stop there for a second. That's a good starting place. So the first thing he talks about is when you intentionally kill somebody. When a man, whoever strikes a man so he dies, shall be put to death. That is willful, intentionally striking somebody. If you go to Numbers 35, which we're going to go there real quick, Numbers 35, that is where kind of murder is more closely defined. And we get a better idea of what he's talking about here because he's going to define it more clearly in Numbers chapter 35. The first 33, 34, I can count. Look at verse 16. Because he's talking about the cities of refuge, which we're going to refer back to in just a second. But he actually defines what cities of refuge aren't for. Okay? Verse 16. But if he struck him down with an iron object so that he died, he is a murderer. The murderer shall be put to death. If he struck him down with a stone tool that could cause death and he died, he is a murderer. The murderer shall be put to death. Or if he struck him down with a wooden tool that could cause death and he died, he is a murderer. The murderer shall be put to death. The avenger of blood shall himself put the murderer to death. When he meets him, he shall put him to death. And if he pushed him out of hatred or hurled something at him lying in wait so that he died, or in enmity struck him down with his hand so that he died, then he who struck the blow shall be put to death. He is a murderer. The avenger of blood shall put the murderer to death when he meets him. So there's any kind of intentional, malicious, laying in wait kind of murder, anything that's intentional or even in anger is considered murder, and the punishment for that murder is death. He shall surely be put to death. We're going to talk about the avenger in a little while, but probably not right. We may not get there today. But so there's that. That's the idea of when you lie in wait or when you intentionally kill somebody with either pushing or hitting or causing any kind of death to come upon a person, you did it on purpose, then you are a murderer, and the response to that murdering is death. But he goes on later in number 35 to say, if he accidentally pushes the guy so the guy dies, or if there's an accidental, he accidentally drops a stone on the guy's head and the guy dies, or if he accidentally wields a tool and the guy dies because he got hit with a tool, that is not punishable by death, but there is a different response to that. The response to that is then when he recognizes the guy dies and he is supposed to run to a city of refuge, he runs to a city of refuge, God is going to establish six cities of refuge, three on the east side of the Jordan and three on the west side of the Jordan. There are going to be six cities of refuge for those who commit manslaughter, those who unintentionally kill somebody to run to. So here's what happens. You unintentionally kill somebody. You recognize that, you know, you're out in the field working together and you weren't being very careful with your wooden stick. And you happen to swing it around and you pop the guy in the head and he falls over, keels over dead. The response you would do then is you would actually flee. You would run to the city of refuge. And the avenger, which we'll talk about now. The avenger, the word that's translated avenger there in Numbers 35, it's related to a kinsman. A kinsman of the one who died would pursue the one who committed the murder, and that would be the guy responsible for pursuing and killing. Later on, we're going to find, if we get to Numbers 35, that's the actual guy who puts the one to death, is the avenger who does that. The avenger of blood, he's called. So you would run, and you would run to the city of refuge. But when you got to the city of refuge, you would go present yourself to the priest there, because they were Levitical cities. The cities of refuge were considered Levitical cities, cities that the Levites kind of owned. Remember, they didn't get, the tribe of Levi didn't get, is not going to get its own inheritance. It's going to be sprinkled throughout the land. And six of the Levitical cities are these cities of refuge. And so you go there, you present yourself to a priest, and you say, you present your case. Well, guess who's following you? Guess who's chasing you? The avenger of blood is chasing you. And he chases you to the city of refuge, and when he gets there, then there's in a sense, a trial that's held where you present your case, he presents his case, and it's the elders in that city's responsibility to determine whether or not you were guilty of murder or not guilty of murder if it's manslaughter. We call it manslaughter today. If it is manslaughter, then you get to stay in the city of refuge and you're not avenged. You're not avenged. You don't get killed. If they determine that, yeah, you're lying, you actually did it on purpose, then you're turned over to the avenger of blood, and you are then, the blood is avenged upon you. So that's the whole city of refuge thing, and that's the thing that he says, I'm going to appoint a place for you. If he did not lie in wait for him, but God let him fall into his hand, then I will appoint a place to which he may flee. That's the places that he points that they can flee, are those cities of refuge. That's what he's talking about there. And so one of the questions I had was, what does it seem to mean when he says, but if he did not lie in wait for him, but God let him fall into his hands? I think that's spelled out when you get to Numbers 35, and he talks about those who are murderers and those who aren't murderers. That's the distinction. That's the clear distinction, because that's where he again in more detail gives what the places are that person can flee to, that those there are those cities of refuge. Even in the law, he gives a way for someone who has unintentionally killed somebody not to be killed, not to be put to death because of that offense, because of that the way that they caused a life to be taken. I think it's important to recognize that doesn't devalue life, because that person still has to run to the city of refuge. There still is a responsibility on the part of the person who took that life, and there are issues there for that person as he has to run to the city of refuge. But there is a difference between intentional, premeditated, thought about kind of death and accidental death. There is a difference, even in God's mind, there's a difference between those two kinds of causing death. Okay, and so that's the first law concerning death, is if you do it on purpose, which is, you know, defined there in Numbers 35, you hit him with an iron tool, you hit him with a rock, you hit him with a wooden tool, you push him on purpose, anything like that is considered murder, And there's one cure for murder, the murder. There's one thing for the murderer to be done. There's no sacrifice he can offer. There's no you know, penance he can do. The answer is he is to be killed. He is to be killed. He is a murderer and he shall die. That's that clear. So that's the first little thing there. Verse 15 says, "Whoever strikes his father and mother shall be put to death." Remember commandment number 4, five, honor your father and mother. Striking your mom and dad, that's not honoring them. That's dishonoring your father and mother. So anyone who would strike father and mother was to be put to death. Again, why is that? You know, that seems harsh, right? It seems you can kill a man and run to a city of refuge, but you strike your mom or dad and you're supposed to die. Does that not seem harsh? It seems harsh, but I think it's rightfully harsh. I think it's rightfully harsh because again, what is God attempting to do with the law? He's attempting to, he's showing, especially in these laws that start off in verse 21, in chapter 21, verse 1, where he said, "Now these are the rules you shall set before him." The word rules really has the idea of the caustic law, the law that says this is how you interact with each other. And I think what he's doing in this social law, a lot of things we see here are social law. What he's doing here is preserving society. It's this law is what God intends to use for society to be preserved, and the building block, the foundational building block of a preserved society, are healthy families. That's just a fact. That's why the first commandment after the love your Lord your God commandment isn't don't kill. The first commandment is honor your father and mother. And that's important because God is establishing and protecting society by protecting the family. That's what he's doing. He's protecting the family, protecting society. And that's why, as soon as he talks about murder there, talks about death, he goes right to whoever even strikes his father and mother shall be put to death. Shall be put to death. Not just say he's sorry. Not just lose the hand he struck the mom and dad with. No, it was very significant and very severe. If he struck his mom and dad, then he should die. That's interesting because there are other places where if there's harm done between individuals, between two individuals, two adults, it says if you harm someone and you break his arm, it's broken bone for broken bone, fracture for fracture. If you put out an eye, it's put out an eye. If you lose a tooth, it's lose a tooth. It's eye for eye, tooth for tooth, bone for bone. That's how that's dealt with, except in the case of child striking mom and dad. Child striking mom and dad is dealt with very harshly because that's dealt with death. It's the response is death. And I don't think that's accidental. I think that's on purpose because what God is doing, again, these laws that are given are laws that are given with the intent of and desire to preserve and protect society, the society that the Jews were going to have. And because of that, again, I believe that the building block of that, the main building block of that is the family. Why? Well, because it's in the family that values are built and grown. It's in the family, a dad doing his job, teaching his son the way he's supposed to teach. See, that's when we get to Deuteronomy, God sets the family up as the primary vehicle for knowledge of God to be passed on from generation to generation. He doesn't establish the priesthood as that primary place for knowledge of God to be passed on. He doesn't establish a priesthood. He doesn't say, "And you priests shall teach the law day and night. You'll be the ones that answer all the questions about the law." That's not what he says. In Deuteronomy 6, he says, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord God, the Lord is one. You shall love the Lord God with your heart, soul, strength, and mind." And he says, "This book of the law will depart. You'll teach it to your kids when you get up, when you lie down, when you go in, when you come out." He says, whose responsibility is it to teach the law, to teach the truth about God to the next generation? It's the father's responsibility. It's the parent's responsibility to do that. And if a parent doesn't have a place in his child's mind where there's honor and respect, then he will disregard what his mom and dad say. So the quickest way for society to fall apart is for a generation that grows up that doesn't honor mom and dad and doesn't give any credibility to the things they teach. Well, that's the second quickest way. The first quickest way, which would be the quickest way, actually, when you use the EST, that's superlative, right? So the quickest way is for mom and dad not to teach. That's the quickest way, is for mom and dad not to teach, which is exactly what Israel ended up doing in the land. In the land, the tragedy is that while God gave Israel this law, he spelled it out for them, he told them what would make them successful and how they would live successfully in the land, Israel disregarded it completely disregarded it, didn't honor it, and within one generation, Judges 3 says, that's the next generation of the land rose up that didn't know God. How does that happen? That happens because dads didn't do their job, but I think it also happened because there's a generation that rose up that didn't honor mom and dad either. And so that's very, very important. That relationship, that rightfully honoring mom and dad is very important in God's estimation. So verse 15, whoever strikes his father and mother will be put to death. That's serious. That's significant. It's important. Yeah, Ron? Yeah, actually, it's actually here in Exodus 21, verse 17. It says exactly that. Not only do you strike, and we'll get there in just a second, but this relationship, a proper understanding, a proper submission to parental authority is very important to God. It is a failure to do so is a killing offense. It is a death offense. Every other death offense either is stealing something from somebody or killing somebody, or striking mom and dad, or cursing mom and dad. Those are the death offenses in Israel. That's what's there. And so this is right up there in importance with thing. And why is that? Well, I think it's because, again, it's that building block. It is that family relationship that is going to lead to success for Israel in the land. Little rabbit trail here. You know, God even says to them, when you get into the land, you need to utterly drive out all the inhabitants of the land. Why did he say that? Because, well, first of all, because the Canaanites were cursed under the curse of Ham and Canaan back in Noah's day. So they were cursed. They were supposed to be driven out of the land. But he goes on to say that if you don't, you're going to live next door to them. You're going to live with them, and the abominations that you see as abominations now, the closer you get to them, the longer you live with those abominations right beside you, the more acceptable those abominations become, the more normal they seem, and the more you recognize, hey, Agag the Canaanite, he's not such a bad guy. You know, he's raising his family just like I'm raising my family. He's planting his crops just like I'm planting my crops. There's nothing really that wrong with him. Oh, he worshiped a different God, but you know what? He's trying his best. He's working hard. He's going to get there. And so the abominable things that are abominations become less abominable, become more acceptable. Not only that, but my son needs a wife, and you know that Canaanite daughter, she is pretty cute. Let's put those together, and before long you have this the children who are no longer pure, no longer separate, no longer. And there's, you know, what happens typically when you have worshiping man's way put alongside worshiping God's way, what do we always do? We always worship man's way. We typically do not worship God's way when we have the choice between the two. And so even the driving out really is an attempt to protect the family in Israel. That's really what it's all about. Family is super important to God. Super important to God. First, because it's a picture of his relationship with Israel. Second, because it's a picture of Christ's relationship with the church. And it is a building block for a successful society. It really is. Family done right. So it's really important. Verse 16, we're going to move to the next one. Unless somebody else wants to say something. Good. You notice how quickly I look down. Whoever steals a man and sells him, and anyone found in possession of him shall be put to death. So if you go out and you steal a man and sell him to somebody else, both the stealer of the man and the purchaser of the man will be put to death. Did you catch that? Did you catch that and in there? It's a really important and, because both are responsible. I think that's where we develop laws in our society that say buying, receiving stolen property is illegal. Okay, I think that even points back to this part of the Mosaic Law, where not only is the man who stole the man guilty of and liable of death, but the one who bought the man is also guilty and liable of death. That's a really important and, because it's whoever steals the man and the one found in possession of him shall be put to death. So those both die for that thing. So, what's that look like? Well, if you go out and steal a man, you go out and steal your brother, you take him away, and you sell him to somebody else, then, and you're found, it's proven you've done that, then you're going to die, and so is the guy who bought him going to die. I wonder if maybe, what is the guy who wrote Amazing Grace? I had his name in my head just a second. Say again? That's the guy, John Newton. I kept thinking Isaac Watts, and I mean, that was the wrong guy. John Newton. I wonder if he, you know, might have been reading this when he got there. You know the story of John Newton? John Newton was a slave trader. He would steal men all the time and would sell them to somebody else, and he was so stricken with that he stopped doing it, of course, wrote Amazing Grace, came to faith. And I wonder what he thought when he read, "Whoever steals a man and sells him, and anyone found in possession of him shall be put to death." Why is that important? Well, because you not only are you stealing and treating a human as property, but you're certainly not loving your neighbor as yourself at that point. You're saying, I am, my own happiness, my own wealth, my own benefit and gain is more important than this person's life in the first place. So there's significance in stealing a man and selling him, because the one who steals him and the one who buys him are both worthy of death. Verse 17. Whoever curses his father or his mother shall be put to death. There's exactly what Ron was talking about earlier. Not only, yes, Dave Henserling. Thank you, Kurt.
Actually, I was a little late with my hand. I wanted to step back.
Step back all you want to.
My verse doesn't read that way, and so I was wondering why that is. Mine seems to indicate that the kidnapper, whether he has him in the soul or he still has him in possession, is put to death. It doesn't seem to indicate at all.
Yeah, so that's a translation difference in what do you have? New King James? Is that what you have?
I'm reading New King James.
Yeah. Yeah, so that is a, I am not a Hebrew scholar, nor am I the son of a Hebrew scholar, okay? I get that. But when you're translating Hebrew, there's some art to that as well, if you will. Translation, biblical translation is not a science. There's some art to it. The guys who translated the ESV, that's what I'm reading. I'm reading the ESV. They chose to say that they understood where all the Hebrew conjunctions and all those kinds of things fall in place, that the better reading for that would be this. Now, that's you know how I read it. You could say because there it's not a mistranslation. It's a separate alternate translation to say that. But whether the kidnapper, whether he has him or has sold him, still both are worthy of death. That's worthy of death. All that changes is that the guy who buys him isn't necessarily worthy of death, but the kidnapper himself is worthy of death. I think, and again, I did several. Little bit of reading about that and looking at that. I think the ESV translation, because of the guys I trust, is a better translation of that text. That's because the guys I trust. The guys I read, all right? That doesn't mean the other's wrong, but I'm glad you brought that up. I'm glad you brought that up. So if you take the ESV, English Standard Version translation of that text, it says... the guy who stole and sold and the guy who bought are worthy of death. If you take the New King James, it does say, and I should have gone there because I do read the New King James. It does say that the one who steals, whether he has him in his possession still or whether he sold him, that person is still worthy of death. Both are good. Both are good. I'll just stop right there. Warren. This is talking about, and specifically, this has in mind Israel, Hebrew people. Right. Right. So this is a, so let's talk about that. That's great. That's great. I'm glad you brought that up. So this does not refer to those conquered in foreign wars, all right? Let's talk about that first. Let's talk about that first. What was God's intention, for, especially when they went in to take Canaan, what were they supposed to do with all the inhabitants of Canaan? They were supposed to either kill them or drive them out. Were they supposed to take them as slaves? No. So this is clearly not talking about those conquered in Canaan who turned themselves into slaves or became slaves. There was not supposed to be that. That was not in God's plan. There were not supposed to be any Canaanite slaves at all, okay? It wasn't supposed to happen. So it's not talking about Canaanite slaves who were conquered in battle. There was not supposed to be any of those. They were supposed to be killed. There's only, you know, if you read through even the conquest, there's only one exception to that rule, and her name is Rahab and her family. That's it. That's it. No one else is supposed to be spared. If you read Joshua, you remember they're in the land and the Gibeonites come? The Gibeonites who hear about these Jews coming and they know we're dead people. You can't stop these Jews, not because of them, but because of their God. That's what Rahab says. We've heard about your God and I'm scared to death of him. I don't want to die. And so, but the Gibeonites have heard these guys are coming. So they let their bread get old, and they put on these old clothes. They make themselves all dirty, and they start wandering like nomads. And it just so happens they wander up to Joshua and say, "Oh, we're wanderers just like you are. We're trying to find a place to live. Is there any way we could be your servants, that we could be your slaves?" And without consulting God, Joshua says, "Oh, sure." And Joshua commits himself and Israel to the Gibeonites as not going to kill them. And God says, "What have you done? What have you done? You're supposed to have killed them, and now you can't kill them because you've got to honor the treaty you made, so now they'll be your slaves from here on out. They'll be your slaves." Was that a stealing of a slave? Or was that a slave? Was that the Gibeonites making themselves slaves? It's B. They were making themselves slaves, right? They volunteered for slavery when they came, okay? That's important. That was not the Israelites stealing them and making them slaves. That was them making themselves slaves voluntarily when they came to Israel. Israel's slavery. Slavery with regard to Israel's slave or Hebrew slaves. The way a Hebrew became a slave was he would need something. That's the whole idea of slavery in Israel, was so their brother could help a brother. So that a Hebrew brother could help a Hebrew brother. When that Hebrew brother was in need or in distress or at an issue, then Hebrew brother could buy Hebrew brother and pay Hebrew brother the price. Not buying him from somebody else, but buying him from himself. Okay, who initiated that buying? I believe that if you walk through the law, it's the slave that initiated the buying in the first place. He's the one who said, "I will be your slave." But there's a transaction that takes place, and money changes hands. When money changes hands, is that stealing? No. So this is the idea of when a Hebrew man takes a Hebrew slave and doesn't pay for him, he has in effect stolen that man. He has stolen him and made him a slave. That's what's in place here. That's what's at mind here. So that's, he is a slave, but after 7 years, remember, Hebrew slave becomes a Hebrew slave. After 7 years, what does he do? He goes free. He goes free after 7 years. unless he says, I like my life here, I like what's going on here, I like my master, I love my wife, I love my children, I want to stay here, I will stay your slave forever. And that's when then the master, if you will, takes an awl and sticks it through the guy's right ear. And I'm confident there was then some kind of thing put in that ear to keep the hole there. You know, if you ever had your ears pierced and you don't wear an earring in there, guess what happens? The hole closes up, right? So I'm sure there's something stuck in there that would indicate this person is a slave. But not a slave because he was stolen, but a slave by choice. A slave by choice. Who made the choice to stay? Did the master say, you must stay my slave? Or did the slave say, I will stay with you? The slave made the choice. The slave made the choice. You see, slavery in Israel, it always seems that the one who is the slave makes the choice to become the slave or to stay the slave, not the other way around. Not the other way around. As you walk through slavery, that's what you see as you walk through slavery in Israel. And remember, at the end of 7 years, if the guy wanted to go free, he absolutely could. And if he came in, let's go through here again. If he came in as a married man, when he left as a married man. He took his wife with him. But if he came in as a single man and married while he was a slave, then that wife of his actually is property of the master, and the wife and kids stay with master if he chooses to leave. Because he came in single, he goes out single. I think even there is protection, that he doesn't have to go out. He can stay if he wants to with his master. I also believe, because of later teaching, that he actually, if he wanted to, he could have actually tried to buy his wife and kids from that master if he had the funds to do so. It would be hard to do that because he hasn't really been earning money for the last five or six years. So that's kind of a difference between the sojourner slave. Now, one more category of slave. Look what you did, Warren. Look what you did. One more category of slave. There's another category of slave that are like Egyptian slaves or slaves that came in from, they brought with them from Egypt. Those kinds of slaves, those other slaves that aren't Canaanites. Because there are people that are not Canaanites that are going to end up interacting with Israelites, right? It was okay for an Israelite to have a slave like that. And that slave was not considered a Hebrew brother. That slave was not set free after 7 years. That slave was a slave, and that slave was a slave forever. But again, I don't think it was a slave that was a stolen kind of slave. That clearly is not supposed to happen. That would have been a slave that was purchased from somebody else. I don't know how you determine whether that person was stolen in the first place, but if it was proven you bought a stolen man, you're liable for death, I believe. Does that help, Warren? Yeah, you're kind of shaking your head like maybe not. Anyway, that's pretty bad when you answer a question, it takes you 15 minutes, you don't even answer the question, but anyway, talk to me later if that didn't help. So, any other questions? Mike? That's what I'm saying. Yeah, I think that's the picture. Yeah, someone who takes a slave without paying the price for a slave, and then sells that slave to somebody else, basically making the money off that then person is liable of death. And I believe the text teaches that not only the guy who sold him, but the guy who bought him is. New King James teaches it's the guy who stole him, whether he still has him or not, is liable of death. So, okay, all right. Any other questions about that? Brian? Kidnapping. Okay? Kidnapping. Yeah. I'll just leave it there. New King James calls it kidnapping. I'm moving on. Anything else? great. Where were we? Oh, whoever curses. We're already on curses. Curses. Whoever curses, and this is words that when you curse your father and mother, it's the other idea is dishonors. The Greek translation of the Hebrew Old Testament is called the Septuagint. It uses the word that's translated dishonors here. So whoever not only curses, but whoever dishonors his father and mother, which is actually what's spoken to in commandment number 5, right? Honor your father and mother. If you dishonor your father and mother, then it's not just a bad thing. You're liable of death. Again, we've already talked about that. Why is that important? I believe that's important because of the importance of the family, because of the importance of the family. Verse 18. When men quarrel and one strikes the other with a stone or with his fist, and the man does not die but takes to his bed, then if the man rises again and walks outdoors with his staff, he who struck him shall be clear. Only he shall pay for the loss of his time and shall have him thoroughly healed. So if you hit somebody or you're responsible for somebody's injury, so to the point that they lose the ability to work, they lose the ability to go out and do the things they need to do. If you hit them to that point where they have to go to on their bed, it says. So he has to go in and he has to take time off of working, time off of taking care of his field, time off of taking care of the things that he has. Then, but he doesn't die. He's restored to health. He comes out and he's able to walk. Even if he's walking with his staff, he's able to come out and do the work he's supposed to do. You're not scot-free. You're not in the clear. You have to pay, you have to make restitution for the time that he's down, and you have to make sure within your power that he is fully healed. You have to make sure that he is taken care of. Kind of a Good Samaritan thing. I think this is the idea of what happened with the Good Samaritan. Remember, the robbers came and they beat up the Good Samaritan. He didn't die, though. And so what does the Samaritan do? The Samaritan actually follows through and keeps the Jewish law better than the priest, better than the Jew, better than the Levite did. Because he takes him and makes sure that he is thoroughly healed before he walks away. So, of course, now the Samaritan didn't cause it, neither did the Jew, priest, or Levite. But there's that idea of making the person whole physically as well and ensuring that's done. How is that happening? Well, it would be a money transaction that takes place. You would pay for the time off. You would pay for the healing. You would pay for them being made well. We have laws and statutes in place that really kind of mirror this. Our insurance company usually takes care of most of that kind of stuff for us, and we don't even know it. But that's typically what happens in those kinds of things. But it does say that if he comes out and walks in, then he shall be clear. So there's no avenging at that point. Because the guy lived, the guy didn't die, then the avenger of blood can't come after you to kill you. There's no blood for blood here. But you get to you're clear, but you have to make sure that you pay for his loss of time, and make sure that he is well. Make sure that he is well. Yep, go ahead, Harvey. No, it doesn't. It's when there's a quarrel and that happens, so that it can be either guy that's quarreling. And the point is, it takes two to quarrel. You know, you unless you are a split personality or something like that, you quarrel with yourself. It takes two people to have a fight. It really does, in a quarrel. Typically, yes. Verse 20. How much time we got? We got time. When a man strikes his slave, male or female, with a rod, and the slave dies under his hand, he shall be avenged. He shall be avenged. When a man strikes his slave, male or female, and the slave dies under his hand, he shall be avenged. What does that mean? What does that mean? It means he shall die. It means he shall die. When you see that word avenged, that is the idea that has the whole track back to the avenger of blood that's being talked about. So if you strike your slave, and you strike your slave so your slave dies, male or female slave, so your slave dies, then the avenger of blood can get you, You can die for that. But here's something I'm not positive on. I'm still working through this one. But if the slave survives a day or two, he is not to be avenged, for the slave is his money. What I'm working through right there, and I haven't got a good definite answer on it yet in my head, is does the slave just have to live a day or two, and then the slave dies and nothing happens? Or how does that work? I don't know the answer to that question yet. I'm not there. I don't know if that means you hit your slave and he gets, he goes down, you just, oh, please live for two more days. Just live for a couple days, that way I'm fine. I don't know if that's the case. That's the one I'm not good with yet. I don't understand that one yet. The good news is I'm not going to have a slave, so I don't have to worry about it. Yes? So something else I think is important, and maybe I didn't do this with when the Bible talks about a slave and doesn't define it as a sojourner who is a slave or a non-Hebrew slave, the reference or the inference there is that it is a Hebrew slave. The Moses and God delineate when they're not talking about Hebrew slaves. So when he is talking about Hebrew slave, when he is talking about slave and just uses the term slave, I believe he's talking about Hebrews, Jewish slaves. Because when he's not talking about Jewish slaves, he always indicates that he's not talking about Jewish slaves. He talks about, he will define them as even the slave who is a sojourner, or even the Egyptian slaves that you have, or whatever. He'll define it that way. When he doesn't define it that way, he typically is referring to a Hebrew slave of a Hebrew. Yeah, it's a good question. Should be, because of the word itself. The word avenger has the idea of a kinsman of that person. That's the Hebrew word. That the Hebrew word means a kinsman of that person. That's what it means. So, again, not being a Hebrew scholar, I have to rely on other folks, but that's a common understanding of that word through every guy I've read. Everybody I've read has the indication that that avenger is a kinsman of the one who died. So it would make sense that it's still a kinsman of the one who died. Yep. Chris. Okay, so Chris said that the master has the right to punish the slave if he's disobedient, and the fact that he doesn't die may indicate that there was no intent to kill. That's not an uncommon understanding of that. I could hitch my wagon to that, but I'm not 100% confident about that yet either. So that's a good understanding. Yeah, Warren, don't do it again, man. Don't you start it. Yeah. And I agree that a slave is an investment. And I think that's what actually is talked about here. When he says, if he doesn't die for two or three, one or two days, then he won't, there's nothing, no punishment because the slave is his money. I think that's exactly what's being talked about here. That your picture is exactly right. The reason is the slave is his investment. And maybe a light bulb just came on in my head, that it's because he has money in the slave, he sees that money, that slave as an investment, he didn't mean to kill him. I may be coming to something. The two of you may have helped me do something here. It may be that there's no indication, no desire to kill because he didn't hit him hard enough to die necessarily. I'm going to think on that. Brian? Yes. For the time period that he is a slave, he is considered property. Absolutely, he is. So that's where it gets a little bit weird. Yeah, but he is considered property because he was purchased. Go ahead. Well, that's a good question. The Brian's question was, he was to be treated well. Why would he be beaten? I don't know. So I don't know that this is a case of normality here. This may be a way to address any kind of abnormal situation that might happen. I don't believe that every Hebrew master was beating his Hebrew slaves to the point of death and hoping they didn't die. But I do think what's going on here is I think there's a point back to Egypt that's going on here. I think that's what's kind of driving some of this slavery or words. I think it's a point back to Egypt. Because remember, in Egypt, they had taskmasters that would beat them, right? We see that happening. Remember when Moses is out walking around before he leaves Egypt, and he sees the Egyptian taskmaster beating the Hebrew slave? That seems to be a normal thing. And I think there's some kind of idea of protection here, that there's, even in this law, there's a protection of, there's a pushing back. So what would it be? Well, if I'm going to beat my slave, be careful. Maybe I don't want to beat my slave. If the fact is, if I hit him hard enough and he dies, I can be put to death. What does that maybe make me not want to do? Maybe I don't want to hit him at all. Maybe I don't want to beat him at all, because if I beat him hard enough so that he dies, I die. Well, then maybe I don't want to worry about whether he lives 2 or 3 days or 1 or 2 days. I want to not hit him at all. There's some kind of protection there, I think. I think there's some kind of protection there. So we'll say that. Yeah, Vince. Yeah, and so what Vince says, maybe he's addressing an issue that the slave's not necessarily always upright anyway. And I think there may be an indication of that. How did the guy get destitute in the first place? It may be because he wasn't making good decisions. It may be because there was something going on there. So that might be part of it. Chris, and then we got to go. Yeah, he said Proverbs 10:13 that, you know, there is a rod for who is void of understanding. And I think the rod was used much more frequently in those days than the rod is used today. Yeah, Dave, I said him then. And go ahead. Yes. Yep. Yeah, and so that could be, and that probably is, you know, you would be disciplining your slave because he was disobedient, because he didn't do what you told him to, because he was maybe even stealing from you, whatever. But what's the right response for a slave who's stealing from you? It's not necessarily to hit him, it's to have him killed, you know, because the punishment for stealing is death. Yeah, John?
Sorry.
No, it's okay. It's okay. I thought we'd finish this chapter today, but I knew better. Go ahead. Specifically in the New Testament, there is the word in the Greek Septuagint translation. There is the word doulos, which is a bondservant or a slave. So the idea that is it is not an employee. This is a slave who is is property. It's a slave who's property. And again, I know it's hard to rationalize how you treat a brother, but again, slavery in Israel is supposed to be a loving thing where you helped your brother out for a period of 6 years and then you let him go free. That's what it was about. And the year of Jubilee, every 50 years, everybody went free. Everybody went free anyway. Trouble with that is not a Sabbath year was ever kept and no year of Jubilee was ever kept, so no one ever really went free. So. Israel didn't do a very good job before they went into captivity of keeping the law, which may indicate why the Pharisees were so hard about keeping the law after captivity. Talk about that later. All right, it's really 5 minutes after I'm supposed to be done, so we're finished. Thanks. Good job. Bye.